doesn't need a great deal of introduction because we have had so many fine contacts with him and his colleagues in the Association of Theological Schools over the years. I say this not because he's here, but because I really believe it, and I guess in part because I will, in a few weeks, no longer be as directly associated with theological education as I have been for 20-some years, that the man who is speaking to us today is a man of integrity, a man of competence, a man of friendship and goodwill to this institution. ATS has not been the friend of this institution in the minds of some. In years past, that is not the friend we would like it to have been in some people's judgment. But from my perspective and the work that needed to be done and the help that needed to be given, I challenge that observation, and I do so wherever I go. ATS, in spite of the Atlanta resolutions of 1974 and some other actions, has been a friend to this institution. It has given us support, good counsel, good direction, and assistance in various ways during these rebuilding years. And in my judgment, a major share of the credit for that kind of helpful posture, which I think symbolizes the best in the association of schools helping each other in the service of theological education, a major share of the credit for that kind of relationship to us goes to the man who's speaking to us this morning. Marvin has brought a great deal of distinction to the association in many of the bread and butter programs of the ATS, not the least of which is the program he's addressing this morning on the Doctor of Ministry degree. A relative newcomer in American theological education, like many newcomers, a program that began with shaking steps and some problems. Again, the association's leadership in bringing stability, direction, and standards to the Doctor of Ministry degree are largely attributable to Dr. Marvin Taylor. Without further ado, Marvin, we bid you welcome, and we wish you many, many blessings in your work, and we're looking forward to your presentation this morning. Marvin?
It's always nice to be here. Some days you come more easily than others. I'm reminded of an old vaudeville joke that where the comedian says he wanted to go to Chicago in the worst way, and he did, by Greyhound bus. Today I would have sort of welcomed Greyhound bus, although last Saturday one of my dear friends from Washington who was riding a Greyhound bus from Indianapolis to Dayton to spend the weekend with us called and said, the bus has a flat tire at Newcastle, Indiana. Will you come after us? So I didn't even have that to lean back on. I think some of you know one of the things that I like to do that's a very personal kind of pleasure is fly a little airplane. And I had originally planned to fly it into here, and yesterday they told me there was no way I would get a clearance into St. Louis this morning because of the weather that was approaching. So I used the backup reservations that I'd made on TWA. You know how good that was now. We sat on the ground in Dayton this morning for an hour and 15 minutes waiting for Indianapolis Center to give the plane a clearance to take off. And I was caught. I appreciate the words, the personal words of your president. This association has a tough job to do with some, I usually say 57 because I'm never sure of the number, 57 different varieties of Protestantism plus the Roman Catholic Church and its membership. We studiously avoid any effort to meddle in things theological. We are not always perceived as being successful in that, as those of you who experienced the events of 1974 will recall. But as I told John Klotz in the back of an auditorium filled with some angry people in Atlanta, we must have done something right because everybody seemed to be mad. And I have received as many hostile letters across the years about what we did to your colleagues down on Grand Avenue as I have to what we did to you. That is, it was a no-win situation for the Commission on Accrediting, and it tried to work its way through without drawing distinctions that were based on any judgments that would be theological in nature, but were strictly educational in nature. Some of you may have seen the article on shortcut degrees in Christianity Today recently. Would you believe I've received an even dozen letters in which the behavior of ATS in relationship to 801 Demun was mentioned as a result of that? You weren't even mentioned in the article. The diploma mills were mentioned, but the fact that ATS had not accredited those diploma mills was looked upon with a great deal of distress, I think, by persons who held degrees from them, although no one admitted that in the letter that was written. But we were accused of being biased against those institutions because they are conservative theologically, not because they fail to meet normal educational standards or any other reason such as that. And it's been fun to share those letters with Ken Conser, the editor of Christianity Today. What most of you don't know Kenneth Conser does is that I badgered him for a year and a half to get him to do the research and write that article because I thought it needed to be done. Too many inquiries come to us about degrees of that kind. I'd like to talk, first of all, a bit about the history of the DMIN degree. You may think that that will be a bit boring, but I don't think it is, because I think there's much to learn from the association's attention to the history of the DMIN degree. A lot of people, especially those who are relatively young in the field of theological education, seem to think that Christer Stendahl invented it in the two-year period between 1968 and 1970 when he chaired a committee appointed by the association. That is far from the truth. The original conversations about a doctorate in ministry were held in the 1930s at the 1936 meeting in which the American Association of Theological Schools was formed as an organized, incorporated body with a constitution and a set of standards for accrediting. There were pleas received by the association from mid-career clergy for doctoral study, not preparatory to an academic career, but professionally helpful in enhancing and furthering their ministries. And those pleas carried with them the request that some delivery system for the degree be devised that would enable them to take advantage of it without resigning parish and going back to the campus and taking up residency again for a sabbatical year or 2 years or whatever it might be. As you well know, in many church polities, that is virtually impossible. If one leaves a call or is unable to obtain an extended leave from a call for additional graduate study. So in 1936, the association appointed a committee on theological degrees. It gave it two tasks. The first one was to sort out what the normal degrees of a theological school ought to be. There was no agreement at all in those days that pre-ordination education should be called a Bachelor of Divinity, that a Master of Theology or a Master of Sacred Theology might be added on top of that, and a Doctor of Theology added still on top of that, which of course all of us recognize is a pretty standard approach to a layered system of seminary degrees. There was no agreement about that in 1936. There had been no policing body of any kind. Every seminary in the land was free to do whatever it wanted to with respect to degrees. Some didn't offer any. They simply gave what would be the equivalent of a certificate of approval for ordination, and a church body ordained the person. And he went out degreeless to serve in the church. Since his only goal was the parish ministry, he didn't need a degree, was not required for ordination, and it was only as theological education, which in many ways had been out of the mainstream of American higher education. It was only as it began to get into the mainstream of that the whole system of degrees took on some coherence parallel to bachelor's, master's, doctor's in the graduate schools of the universities of this country. So that was the first task that had to be performed by the committee. The second task was to address this request. The minutes say requests from hundreds of inquiries for a professional doctorate. And it was in 1936 in the ATS minutes for that meeting that the term home doctoral study first appeared. Many of the critics of DMIN programs in 1981, who feel that the programs are less residential, less academic, less demanding than they ought to be, think that was invented in the last 2 or 3 or 4 years as DMIN programs began to proliferate. It was not at all. Well, ATS responded to that like it responds to a lot of things. It appointed a committee. The committee studied it. It brought a report. The committee was thanked for the report. The first time around, it was not even accepted in principle. It was just thanked for the report. The committee was continued and asked to report again in 2 years. 1940, the committee reported, suggesting a pattern for a DMIN, nobody thought to call it that in those days, but a professional doctoral degree. And this was the pattern that was proposed. And notice what it says about us as a group of schools. We really didn't trust each other to do quality education in professional doctorates. So the pattern that was proposed was that there be created by the association, the title that was used was an American Theological College. This college would set standards, would establish curricula, would give examinations, would authorize the awarding of degrees. Any individual institution that wanted to respond to those standards by implementing the curriculum would be free to do that. But no institution would be authorized to award degrees until its students had submitted themselves to the discipline of the central examinations that would be given by the American Theological College. I wish I had been at the 1942 convention when that proposal was put on the table. Apparently it was rousingly debated. On the one hand, there was a group of schools that felt that it was very denigrating to suggest to them that they did not have both the competence and the integrity to manage this degree program. After all, they had managed their affairs for many years, many decades, without question, and one more degree could be added. Others felt that it would give a competitive advantage to some schools simply because they would have the resources to mount such a curriculum. And it would attract students not at the professional doctoral level, but at the Bachelor of Divinity level in a way that in the long run would be harmful to their more modest institutions, unable to amass those doctoral level resources. And so the proposal was approved by a minority, but rejected by a majority. Well, the committee did what all good committees do. It went back, having been instructed by the debate that it heard at that convention, and came forth next with a proposal for a professional doctorate with a set of standards, library requirements, faculty requirements, curriculum requirements, the usual kinds of standards that would establish a DMin degree individually in individual schools that wanted to do it. They expected that while the small group of schools that had supported the American Theological College, that is the centralized control principle, might be offended, everyone else would be happy. But they were wrong. When they proposed this, once again it was adopted in principle, but referred back to the committee. The language of the resolution was to study its potential implementation. And that went on biennium after biennium after biennium, until in 1952, a diligent search of the minutes of that particular meeting indicates that the committee was dismissed with thanks. The professional doctorate does not appear in the minutes. The committee apparently did not report in writing so that it got into the docket for the meeting. And between 52 and 62, there is nothing in the ATS records about a professional doctorate. But persons who have been on faculties during that particular decade and have read some things I've written about this tell me that the debate went on within faculties, because clergy were saying, we don't just want continuing education, although we do want that. We want continuing education organized in such a fashion that it can have an appropriate reward in the form of a degree. Once again, no one having thought to invent the term DMin, Doctor of Ministry. In 1964, down at Fort Worth, two distinguished administrators, one a Methodist, one a Lutheran, spoke to that meeting in ways that were very disturbing to the vast majority of delegates from theological schools. The Methodist was Ernest Cadman Caldwell, that some of you will recognize from his work in the field of New Testament. He had been the dean of the Divinity School at the University of Chicago in the early 40s, and when Robert Maynard Hutchins, the president of the university, decided to make himself chancellor, which in essence meant he didn't have to worry about such mundane details as budget and other things like that, but could be the great idea man for a great university, Caldwell became president to mind the store. But while he was dean of the Divinity School, he accomplished two things, I think, of considerable significance in the history of theological education in the country. One was to pull off the merger called the Federated Theological Faculties in Chicago, in which a group of schools were able to get together and in effect merge their faculties and create a single curriculum that functioned both at the bachelor and doctoral level, the BD, or the DB as Chicago chose to call it, and the PhD level. I think the second thing that he was able to do was to bring the Divinity School more clearly than it probably had been for many, many years into the mainstream of the university's life, so that it wasn't just something stuck in the center of the campus in Swift Hall, but was a significant entity in the total life of the university, something I think his successors have been able to do. Seward Hiltner, recently retired from Princeton, tells me that Seward was on the faculty at the Divinity School in those days before he'd moved to Princeton, tells me that in the early days of forming the Federated Theological Faculty, one of Caldwell's goals was to abandon the Bachelor of Divinity degree, to lengthen the time from 3 years to 4 years, and offer a Doctor of Religion degree to all preordination candidates. And the debates in those faculties waged mightily. in the early years of the 1940s. He lost that battle, not so much because the faculty members identified with the divinity school were opposed to it, but because those identified with the Disciples of Christ institution there, Meadville Seminary, the Unitarian School, Chicago Theological Seminary, were opposed to it. They were opposed to it for the very practical reason that they doubted that a great overwhelming number of their potential BD students had any interest in one more year of seminary education. And that since they represented denominations where students would have other alternatives to turn to for seminary education, they might end up with the finest doctoral degree in ministry in which no one was enrolled because the students had all gone elsewhere. So it was not accepted at the University of Chicago in the 1940s. Well, meanwhile, Caldwell moved briefly down to Emory University. And then when the Methodist Church chose to move its seminary out of the University of Southern California to Claremont and create Claremont, the Graduate School of Theology at Claremont, which we all refer to as Claremont, even though that is not the legal title at all. It doesn't even appear in the title. The legal title is the School of Theology of Southern California. When they chose to do that, Caldwell had a new faculty, a new group of people to persuade. And whether they were less resisting or he was more persuasive, I know not. But he was successful, so that in 1963, Claremont launched the first Doctor of Religion degree as a professional degree. It was a four-year degree. It contained a substantial experiential component, although nothing like the typical Lutheran internship, because the component was carried out in parishes close enough to a campus that one could be involved in the greater Los Angeles area in frequent in-parish and on-campus activities sequentially while staying in residence at the school. Very quickly, the Divinity School, led by Jerry Brower, followed by adopting a Doctor of Religion degree. So that in 1964, these two men, speaking at the ATS meeting in Fort Worth, simply announced they were going ahead to do this. Well, there was everything from surprise to total outrage expressed on the floor. I've gone back and read some of the correspondence, which is still in the files, that came to the Commission on Accrediting between 1964 and 1966. Presidents of schools, deans of schools wrote and said, you know, they ought to be removed from the accredited list. They no longer meet the standards for accreditation. The answer that Claremont and Chicago gave to that was, there were no standards for Doctor of Religion degrees. How could they be held in violation of non-existent standards? The BD standards, and if you want to make a four-year out of it, then BD plus THM standards, simply didn't apply to what they were doing. They had created a new degree, a new animal, as it were. And if they were going to be judged, they would have to be judged by yet-to-be-written standards designed to deal with that new entity. Well, the commission, which has never been known for its aggressiveness, didn't quite know what to do, and it continued to temporize on that issue until, in 66, a committee was appointed to write standards for the DMIN degree. It wasn't called that yet. It was still called the professional doctoral degree, but to write standards. But please note what happened. All during the 1930s, 36 on, and the 40s, while the Committee on the Professional Doctorate was functioning, it was functioning to consider the creation of a doctorate for mid-career practicing clergy that would meet their professional needs. And when two member schools get around to creating a professional doctorate, it totally ignores those needs. It's a preordination degree designed to lengthen preordination education and provide absolutely nothing post-ordination, so that the seminary would continue to focus all of its energies in professional education on those years prior to the beginning of ministerial experience full-time. I think it's interesting that we fell into the professional doctorate in such an absurd way as an association. Let me say parenthetically that I suppose our track record as an association in creating standards, that is, dealing with the novel, is really very bad. We don't know how to write standards in a vacuum. You know, we can pick a committee that I'm sure you could get near unanimous consent for as having on it the best minds across the association, and they get together and dream, and their dreams are often interesting, but they are unreal until some school has the courage to start something new and take whatever the gaff is that it has to take for having had such courage, that is, to break ranks with the membership. And then we have something to look at. We can begin to evaluate it. We can see what turns out to be good practice, what turns out to be poor practice. And in doing that, then start to write standards. The set of standards written by Christer Stendahl's committee, and that was a Blue Ribbon committee if we ever appointed one, were virtually useless, because they were written at a time when the association had not experimented sufficiently with the degree to have an informed membership ready to evaluate. So that the debate then at the Claremont meeting in 1970, I've always thought it was a great irony that the first meeting that really put its blessing on the professional doctorate would be held on the campus at Claremont, the school that precipitated it all by outraging everybody in the association by its unilateral action. The president of Claremont, Gordon Michelson, who was president then, said to me during the course of that idea, incidentally, is not original, said to me during the meeting, "It's a shame Pomp Caldwell is dead. He would enjoy every minute of this," knowing simply that it finally got approved at that campus that had been so soundly condemned by so many schools. Well, what happened? In 1969, there were actually, a year before the Stendahl Committee, there were actually seven schools in the association offering degrees that could be called professional doctorates. None of them yet called it a doctor of ministry. There were about 300 students enrolled. That included all of the people at the University of Chicago and at Claremont that you and I would refer to as BD students in those days, because they did not have any other degree to offer. The rest of, and the students also at Meadville Lombard, the Unitarian school in Chicago, which has never had more than a very small enrollment. So those three schools had what has come to be known as an in-sequence or a four-year straight through degree. Now, in addition to that, Chicago Theological Seminary, which had since withdrawn from the Federated Theological Faculty, along with the other schools, and in essence broke up the Federated Faculty by its withdrawal, Chicago Theological Seminary had created a Doctor of Religion degree, same name, that they called an in-experience degree. And sometimes, if you go back to their early literature, they call it a post-experience degree. I never quite knew what that meant. Somehow it sounded like something you did in retirement years or something of that sort. At any rate, what they were trying to say was, you can't get into this until you have had several years in the ministry. Years that will clarify who you are, will clarify your perspectives on ministry, will help you to sort out what you need to strengthen, to undergird, to improve your ministry, and we'll take a handful of people each year into this program, never more than about a dozen. It was a 15-month-long residential full-time program, so that one was forced to make sabbatical arrangements with a parish in order to participate in it. You came in June of one summer, and you finished in September the following summer. 15 full-time months of doctoral study. Two other schools had a similar kind of program in 69. So the association found itself confronted at the meeting in Claremont with two schools of thought. The majority of students enrolled were enrolled in the in-sequence, the straight-through type of degree. And about half of the institutions offering the degree were of that type. Claremont, Chicago, and Meadville did not have an in-ministry degree. Christian in Indianapolis, Chicago Theological Seminary, and Fuller in Pasadena, and I can never remember who the seventh one was, had professional doctorates for mid-career people that were in ministry degrees. And they virtually required residence at the seminary on a full-time basis, or having a parish that was so close that you could almost function as if you were full-time at the seminary and take a half a load or a third of a load and spread it over a period of years. What to do about that? Well, as is always true, when the association finds itself caught in that kind of dilemma, it tends to equivocate. And we equivocated by legalizing both kinds of degrees. That was distressing to some Lutherans, some Episcopalians, some Roman Catholics, for different reasons. You already have a four-year degree. You don't dare call it a doctor of ministry degree. In fact, you don't want to. I've never met with a Lutheran faculty that thought that, you know, by tinkering with it a little bit here and there, we just call it a D-min and solve our problems. I don't think your church wants that. I don't believe any of the Lutheran churches want that. You have a pattern of education which is now fairly well established, has been for a number of decades, that you believe in as an appropriate pattern for bringing persons into professional ministry. And I had the feeling in some of the conversations about that, that Lutherans were afraid that somehow the in sequence, the four-year straight-through degree, would undercut their efforts. I do not see one whit of evidence to support that as I survey the association. In fact, I would make this bald statement about the D-men, that it tends to be strictly a denominational enterprise. That is, there are denominational patterns of D-men degrees that have emerged. I'll say more of that about that later. So that if there is competition, it will be intra-denominational, not inter-denominational. Let me be very specific in trying to indicate what I'm saying and apply it to you. If your sister institution in Fort Wayne were to create a pattern of education that somehow proved far more attractive to potential students for this campus, then you'd probably have some problems. Students have a way of going the easiest route, even though they profess at the same time that they want a good education. Education is the only thing I know that you can not give a student and make him happy. That is, dismiss a class, and what's the response? Often it's applause rather than distress. But if Eden Seminary in town or Kenrick, the Roman Catholic school, or Covenant Seminary, or Seminex creates a D-man, I don't think that will cause you much trouble. It's been interesting to watch what has happened across the land in this respect. I'm a Methodist, and the Methodist schools are all known as Methodist bird watchers. You know, they watch each other with a very careful hawk-like eye to be sure that no one gets any kind of an advantage on them. And so when some new wrinkle comes in curricularly that is thought to have a potential of attractiveness for students, if it works, you can bet that it will multiply. Now, my colleagues all strenuously deny that, but if you need any evidence, I can give it to you at several places around the land. I'm a former Methodist dean who participated in that, 250 miles to the west in Kansas City. So the D-men is essentially a denominational phenomenon that we are confronted, and your competition is up in Fort Wayne, no place else, in terms of the way you put your degree together and what it will mean for the constituency that you are most likely to serve, members of the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church. Since 1970, when the Stendahl Report was accepted, let me say one other word about the Stendahl Report. Christo and I have talked about this a number of times across the decade. At Claremont, Harold DeWolf, used to be at Boston. Dean DeWolf didn't like one phrase that was in the Stendahl Report, and he moved to amend the report. The phrase said that the D-min is a professional degree built on the AB degree. And DeWolf moved to amend that to say built on the MDiv degree or its equivalent. And I can still see Krister in that auditorium standing there, hunched over a lectern, much as I am, listening to that and trying to decide what to do, whether to argue with Dean DeWolf or to accept it. And he turned around and looked at his committee seated behind him on the stage, and their heads were going this way and this way. So he got about a 50-50 split on what to do, and they did a quick caucus on the stage, and he came back and said, we'll accept that, the report. He said to me later, I don't think it makes any difference. I personally think it has made the world of difference, because what it has meant is that the D-Min has come to be thought of by most of our institutions as a 3+1 rather than a 4-straight-through kind of philosophy. So that an institution builds an MDiv degree, and in your case, of course, you have to add the internship to that, and then thinks about a 1-year pattern of post-ordination, post-experience education that will build on what took place in the MDiv degree and will help persons who have had the opportunity to identify the questions they want to address in additional study to deal with those questions. The results are evident in the statistics. Last year, 85 of our member institutions were engaged in D-Min work. 13 of them claimed to offer in-sequence D-Mins. But those 13 enrolled only about 375 students. There were 5,200 students enrolled in in-ministry D-Mins. Last year, the enrollment in the D-Min constituted about 12% of all of the persons enrolled in all of our seminaries, in all programs. So from practically nothing just a bit over a decade ago, it has grown phenomenally. Only one institution, Union Seminary in Richmond, Virginia, has adopted what I call the Claremont Chicago philosophy of education, the 4 years straight through. Union went to the drawing board, looked at its total curriculum. That's not a subject for us to dwell on today, but it was a fascinating experience that they went through in getting consumer reaction to their existing curriculum before they designed a new one, spread over 18 months with in-depth study of alumni and even more significantly of persons, laity in the churches of those alumni who received the services, the ministerial services of those graduates. Union completely revised its total curriculum, abandoned the MDiv degree, and created a DMin. The funny thing happened at Union. They began to get people who were 25, 26, 27, had already been out working for a while, now felt the Lord had called them into the ministry. And the prospect of 4 years in school, including the dislocation that would be involved in moving to an internship location, which was a part of the third year, but not about half of the third year was devoted to that, they didn't want. And so they began to ask, can't you give us an MDiv degree and let us do, after 3 years, and let us do some postgraduate education later on if we have the interest and the opportunity. Interestingly enough, Claremont 2 years ago, 3 years ago, which between 1963 and 1978 did not award a single BD or MDiv, Claremont has now re-established the MDiv degree as an option for its students. And I badger the dean, Joe Huff, to try and find out how many people, as they come in each year, register in, at the beginning of the first year class, register for the MDiv, and he won't tell me. My own prediction is that it's the death knell for the in-sequence DMin at the institution where the whole thing started. 85 schools. There are about 125 accredited Protestant schools. No, not that many, 115 accredited Protestant schools. So as you can see, most of the Protestant schools have opted for the DMin in an in-ministry style. And much of the work that it has been my lot to administer across the last 6 years, 7 years, has been the carrying out of the accreditation relationships with that. All but about five or six of those now hold some form of accreditation, either full accreditation or preliminary accreditation. The ones that do not hold it are those that are sufficiently new that our machinery simply hasn't gotten around to them yet. I can think of only, I believe, one instance where we have actually done an accrediting visit and declined to accredit the degree, and that school is now back at the drawing boards trying to make the improvements that the Commission on Accrediting suggested to them. I know this has been a fairly long discourse in history, but I think it's an important discourse because I think we need to understand that what was requested by hundreds of people in the 30s and the 40s probably is more desperately needed by thousands of people or tens of thousands of people. I think we need to understand that what was requested by hundreds of people in the 30s and the 40s probably is more desperately needed by thousands of people or tens of thousands of people in the 80s. Because it seems to me, well, let me be personal for a moment. In 1943, in that class, that had any notion that he would do anything with his life other than spend it in a local parish as the pastor of a church. I don't think a single one thought of being a teacher. God hadn't called me to do that. All of the courses were designed to deal with the parish ministry. The word specialized ministry hadn't even been invented in those days.
although everybody knew there were chaplains out here, but somehow we have not dealt with what that meant in terms of preparation. And seminaries certainly weren't preparing people for chaplaincies. But all that's quite different now when we think of ministry. I do not mean to imply that the parish ministry has lost its gloss or anything of that sort, but ministry is much more diverse than we once thought that it was. And seminaries have had to learn how to broaden and sharpen their perspectives to deal with that diversity of ministry. And the parish itself is not the thriving institution that it was in 1943, at least in my church, maybe it is in yours, in which the simple preparation that I received in the 40s was probably adequate for a decade. But the growth of the continuing education programs and centers around the land, almost none of which existed in the 40s, testifies to the needs that clergy have that in seminary days they could never have anticipated, nor could the church have anticipated. Which means that the theological education enterprise, which I like to define as an enterprise that ought to be concerned about the church's ministry from the moment a person is called until the time a person retires, not just from the moment a person is called until the person is ordained, as is so often the case. Let me tell you a story, and then I'm going to stop and let you get some coffee, and then I have a few more things I want to say after that. I mentioned a few moments ago that one of my joys is flying a little airplane around. I'd like to use an illustration from my experience. I may have used it here before. If I have, hold your hands up. Since I enjoy it, I tend to use it often. You take lessons with an instructor, and you read books, and you take a written exam, an exam that's designed to keep people out of the air. It doesn't have much to do with flying. If you pass the exam with a pencil, then you can take a check ride with an FAA pilot to discover whether you can fly the plane or not. And I went out with fear and trembling about 10 years ago when I started flying to take that ride with a FAA pilot who was a sour-looking guy who didn't even say good morning, just said, let's go. And we took off, flew around, and I did the things he told me to. Never once did he say that was okay or good or what makes you think you can fly or anything like that. Just gave me the next set of instructions. As we came back to the airport to land, and I shut down the engine, parked it at his instruction, he turned to me, and for the first time there was direct personal communication. He said, I'm going to go in and type up the temporary certificate. You've passed the exam, and in due time you will get the official one in the mail from the FAA headquarters. But he said, I want to tell you what the certificate means. He said, it means that we trust you to do two things. The first is that you can now take other persons with you when you fly. As a student pilot, you can't do that. You can go solo yourself, but you know, if you kill anybody, it's only yourself. You can now take persons with you. But he said, second thing that the certificate means is that it's a license for your future education. You are not an accomplished pilot. You are barely good enough to get the plane up into the air and get it back down onto the ground in normal weather conditions in a safe fashion. Unless you continue to take responsibility for your continued learning, you'll probably kill yourself and anybody else that's along with you. Apply that to the MDiv curriculum for a moment. A lot of curriculum thought that we do around tables seems to have an unspoken assumption that we have to teach them everything they're going to need to know for a lifetime of ministry. And we try to cram in just as much as we can in those 3 years that we have control over these people. because we're scared to death they're not going to learn anything after they leave. I sometimes think that I'm borrowing this from an English professor out in Utah, but I sometimes think that the curriculum philosophy that we operate under can be described in three declarative sentences. They didn't know anything when they came. They won't learn anything after they leave. And they won't learn it while they're here unless they hear me say it. I know that's insulting, but look at your curriculum. Look at the way it's put together. Look at the unspoken assumptions that undergird it. And that is often where we are. Well, my point is obvious, but I'm going to belabor it anyway. I think theological schools have an opportunity with the D-men to enlarge their horizons, to redefine their mission in relationship to the church, to play a responsible role in something other than just sending faculty members out to clergy conferences, a responsible role in the growth, the upbuilding, the upgrading, the ongoing education of the clergy who do the work of God under your banner with your church. And the D-men is an opportunity to do that. It's not the only opportunity. I hope you won't quit other continuing education things and won't stop going to clergy conferences. But it is one opportunity with a select group of people to play that role. Let's get a cup of coffee and then I'll say a few more things. You're out. I'd like to say a few things now about types of programs, because I think these might be influential as you think of your own design and the work that you're going to do. I suppose since about 1971 or 72, we must have fielded several hundred requests for information at the offices in Vandalia, Ohio. Clergy call, and they always want to know, where are the best D-men programs? Would you give me a short list of the best D-men programs? And of course, I always say that they're all good. They have different virtues, and what are you interested in? I try to be a diplomat. They always say, well, now, you know, we don't want anything that's weak or anything that's going to be looked upon as not being respectable or anything of that sort. And I think it'd be fair to say that Jesse Ziegler and Dave Schuler and I, across the years, have probably been told something about every existing D-men program that says that it's excellent and says that it's lousy. That is, everyone is viewed by someone one way and by someone else another way. And that used to puzzle me. But I think I've begun to understand why. We really haven't accustomed ourselves as a community of theological scholars to the D-men as yet. Most of us who are called doctor earned PhDs or THDs, academic doctorates, and I suppose most of us have been guilty of talking about that cheap doctorate that's now being given to clergy, one way or another, and have described it in language that seems to say it's only a slight step above the Doctor of Divinity degree, that it was an unearned degree in one form or another. And what I've discovered as I roam around the country and talk to faculties is that on almost every campus, there will be a few people who will be a vocal minority raising questions about the program on that campus. Now, sometimes being vocal means grabbing me off in the corner someplace because they don't want to say it out loud, since the institution is committed to the degree. Or saying, gee, you know, when you do the accrediting visit here next year, you really ought to look in on so-and-so. That's not really working too well. and it needs all the help it can get. But when you get them talking about some other school's D-Men program, then there tends to be a unanimity of opposition. So that what's happened is that I think we have become uncomfortably comfortable, if I can contradict myself that way, uncomfortably comfortable with our program, and we still question everybody else's. And the questions usually focus on what I call certain characteristics of the delivery system of the program. They aren't resident on campus. You know, they really aren't students. They're still in the ministry. Or the amount of time that they spend with the faculty is so limited. How could it possibly be a good degree? Or they don't use theological libraries. How could it possibly be a good degree? Look how many students they have. No school could possibly provide responsible education for that many people. On and on. I think what that says about us as a class of people is that the unspoken assumption that undergirds our evaluation of D-Men's is an MDiv-based assumption. That was also true of the AB that we received, and our high school education, and our grade school education. That is, good education is a group of people who spend Monday to Friday in a classroom or in a library in direct daily contact with a faculty and who have no other significant commitments in life to distract them from that engagement with the life of the mind, with education. And anything that isn't built on that particular model must therefore be defective. Now that says an interesting thing about clergy. It seems to say that after they graduate from here and go out, we really have little confidence in their ability to engage in significant continued learning. That is, somehow that learning is viewed as being dependent upon, if not us, some other faculty. And I think that this mixture of very subtle but very real assumptions that flow around in our viscera when we are reacting to D-Men's makes it very difficult for us to design D-Men's that are non-traditional, that are different than the normal pattern of education. Now, I say that at the outset because I want to say some things about non-traditional education. I'm convinced that no school will have a successful D-Men program if by successful you mean reaching a significant number of clergy with effective education unless it alters the design of the delivery system. Because the very people that you want to serve, who are the most likely candidates for your work, are the people who are the busiest in ministry, who are the most effective in ministry. They are the ones who are most likely to be sufficiently self-analytical to say, hey, you know, I really need help in so-and-so. And the person that's plodding along, doing a minimal job, probably is insufficiently analytical to know that he's plodding along, and probably didn't have the point average in the MDiv to get into your program anyway, or whatever other characteristics of potential success you look for in evaluating the records that come to you for admission. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that the programs that have been successful in attracting significant numbers of students, and I define significant here as simply a group of people that's large enough that you can carry on the program and that the school feels that it is being successful in carrying it on. The schools that have done that have been the schools that have tried to work out a way of providing the education to clergy who continue their parishes or whatever their ministry assignment may be. Now, what are the ways they've done that? Well, the way that everybody tried a few years ago was instead of running three-hour classes Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 2 o'clock, you'd do it Tuesday afternoon at 2 o'clock for 3 hours. That worked for a while until you used up the pool of clergy whose churches were within a reasonable geographical area for driving. The price of gasoline, what it is, I suspect that that size of region has begun to shrink a little bit today. Now schools are trying to find ways to deliver this product someplace else than on their campus, or on their campus in different kinds of packages. For example, there are seminars offered on a number of campuses now that are monthly, that last for 3 days, in which the person comes in, they start actually 2 days, but it's spread over three. They start at noon on one day, are in class that afternoon, perhaps that evening, since it's the first day, stay overnight. They're engaged all day the next day, not necessarily in class all that time, because there must be time for library activity and group process work, things of that sort. Stay overnight again and finish up that unit the next morning. So the third day is involved. The two Lutheran schools in Pennsylvania, Gettysburg and Philadelphia, for example, have operated a program on this basis with clergy traveling as much as 400 and 500 miles once a month during an academic year. And they do approximately one half of the coursework during that year, with the balance of the coursework then being individually negotiated kinds of things, some of which might be done directed study, some of which might be done in other educational institutions in approved courses that have been examined and fit that particular student's interests, that sort of thing. Other schools have decided that when you talk about the cost of education, that it's easier to move the faculty member away from the campus than it is to bring a variety of students to the campus to study with one faculty member. So seminars are being held in some strange and wonderful places around the country, you know, like Holiday Inns, church camp settings that have been winterized so that they can be used. One school's program consists of Monday noon through Friday noon units, in which a student does three of those units for 3 years, a total of 9 units, and then does a major project. But the unit that he does that runs from noon Monday to noon Friday actually started 2 months before that, with a reading list as long as his arm and a series of written material that had to be in the hands of the professor in time to be evaluated before Monday noon came for the face-to-face kind of encounter. And then all of the so-called contact hours, the face-to-face dialogue professor to student, takes place between that noon Monday and noon Friday. And then there is another month or 6 weeks following that in which the course gets wrapped up by the student doing projects related to the learning in the parish and reports on those to the professor to complete that. And professors can travel several hundred miles to do that, where students probably could not travel, you know, a group of 15 students or whatever, travel to the campus to spend the Monday through Friday. The logistics are varied in which this is being done, but I'm trying to indicate the ways that schools which 10 years ago would have said, you know, that isn't respectable, are now discovering that it may very well be respectable and that quality education can take place in that kind of away from the library, away from the campus encounter. in which you still force people to find theological libraries and utilize those, but not necessarily everybody using your library on your campus. There are other schools with those. One of the interesting things that I've had to deal with in this friendly little association is the complaints that come to me from one institution when it suddenly discovers that the 20 D-Min students from another institution are using its library more than its MDiv students are using that library, and they didn't even know about it. You know, the school that's offering the D-Min had not given them so much as a buy your leave, or is it all right if we ask or suggest to our students that your library is available, or anything of that sort. Or back to my note about denominationalism earlier, it's interesting to note the way that a church body can set up one of these non-residential seminars across the street, almost literally across the street from a seminary of another denomination. And of course that school, who feels its turf has been invaded, is outraged and wants us to do something about it. And we make no pretense of even trying to do anything about it. The only question we ask is, what's the quality of the program? We can't protect anybody's turf, make no effort to do that. If the quality is all right, then it, you know, can continue and be an accredited thing. But this is one thing I think you will need to consider in design. What's your delivery system going to be? How are you going to serve the people? Do they have to come to St. Louis? Now, the programs that have had the most difficulty with this have been the specialized programs in pastoral care that have had clinical involvement, because it's very difficult to take the clinical involvement out to a church camp setting or to establish any other relationships that do that. Garrett in Chicago or Evanston has a group of Methodist students that are all come from the state of Virginia that are involved in the program, and they have contracted with the Virginia Institute for Pastoral Care, which is an accredited ACPE center of pastoral care, to provide the clinical component for a pastoral care unit. So far as I know, that's the only contractual arrangement of that sort that has been formalized, although there are some informal kinds of things happening in Chicago, for example, with the, I never remember the names, but the pastoral care center that's there with CTS and LSTC and McCormick in a joint program and things like that. The second kind of observation that I would like to make, and I want to rush through these so we'll have time for a few questions, is that, how are you going to organize a D-Min? What's the organizing principle going to be? We tend to think of organizing principles as the ways we got our PhDs. You know, an MDiv is a political degree. I mean, political in the sense that the faculty politics with each other to see how the pie is going to be divided. Scripture gets a certain slice, history gets a certain slice, and you can pretty well tell the political acumen of a faculty by looking at its curriculum. If you don't believe me, look at yours. Is that the way to do a D-Min? I had a phone call one time from a pastor in, I better not tell you where because I'm going to mention a seminary, in a large city, who said, can you recommend a D-Min to me? Well, I said, there are three or four in your town. Well, yeah, I said, I've looked at all of them, but I don't think any of them really meet my needs. And I said, well, what's wrong with them from your perspective? Well, and he started rattling off the reasons why each was not acceptable. One had a system of arranging the courses that he just couldn't possibly fit into. And one of them, he said, I don't want a third of a PhD. And he said, that's what that program is. He said, that's a bunch of scholars who want to do advanced scholarship in theology and scripture primarily. And I'm a clergyman, and I'm certainly interested in theology and scripture, but I want to know where theology and scripture interface with the practice of ministry and address the questions that relate to that. Not more than a week later, the dean of the seminary that offered the one-third of a Ph.D. as a D.Min. called me and asked me why I wasn't getting any more students. I almost laughed in his ear because of the juxtaposition of those two telephone calls. How are you going to organize a D.Min? Are you going to organize it? You know, you've only got 1 year of time. You're going to give them 6 hours of Bible and 6 hours of theology. And will history get any of this? I mean, after all, they already know history, don't they? My apologies to the historians. I could have done the same thing to the theologians. Or is there some other way to organize? How about organizing it around the ministerial experience of your candidates and their needs? What is it that confronts a 40-year-old Missouri Synod pastor these days that he needs help on? Enough help that he's willing to submit himself to the rigors of a year of additional degree study without, you know, wanting to be personally insulting. You know, just let me say flatly, there probably isn't enough wisdom in this room to answer that question. Unless all of you just came from the parish last year. I know some of you did recently. You know, you may want to dialogue with some clergy who are potential candidates for the program about what they want in the program and then devise a way of dealing with that. Now, hear me out. This is not an anti-intellectual observation. Ministry is not richer, deeper, better grounded if it is devoid of advanced biblical and theological, historical, and ministerial theory insights. But we tend to organize courses in those disparate disciplines around the questions that are central to the discipline, not central to the practice of ministry. And I think we need to find the way to use the discipline to address the professional questions of ministry, rather than address the scholarly questions that are more appropriate for an AAR meeting or some other scholarly society. I don't know what that means for you, but we have some seminaries that are really struggling hard with that principle of trying to find a way to organize the curriculum around ministry and find in the scholarly knowledge and insights of their faculty a procedure for informing those questions. I commend it to you as a way of thinking about the program. Let me say one other thing and then I'll stop and you can talk back to me. Apart from the curricular question, which I just posed, the toughest job you will have is deciding what is a professional project in ministry. We know how to write Ph.D. dissertations. We've done that. But what is a professional project? I like to define a D.Min. project as an exercise in which the candidate has done something and then subjected it to the most searching scrutiny that he can possibly do, from his understanding of the discipline of ministry and of the classical foundational disciplines of faith and ministry. I think the difference between a professional and a professional school and a trade school is the professional school teaches its graduates how to be self-analytical, self-critical, self-correcting, because they understand the foundations that undergird the profession that is being practiced and can advance the profession into new arenas that may not have existed when they were in school. We need to learn how to do that as a group of scholars. So that may mean that as you try to devise a DMIN curriculum, you're going to have to struggle with new ways of teaching, in which the old boxes, Bible, etc., are not the correct boxes for the DMIN. There may be a new set of boxes with different words on them. And all of the people, or all of the disciplines, have a place in each of those boxes. Because no dimension of ministry, whether it be preaching, pastoral care, evangelism, education, whatever, is unrelated to a single one of those foundational disciplines. Each, if it is to be genuinely Christian, validly Christian, must draw, nurture from them, lest it just be, 77 snappy sermon starters or something like that. So, I commend to you the process by which you struggle with who your students are that will work in a DMIN, and they'll be radically different people than your MDiv students. They don't just sit down and put in their notebook what you tell them. They've been in the ministry. They will have questions that you may not have anticipated that flow out of what you're doing, and will expect your help with those. Who your students are, what kind of system you're going to be able to devise in terms of calendar in order to deliver a program that students can buy into. And thirdly, how you will organize yourselves as a faculty to do that. Now, along the way, as you're working away at those particular tasks, if you have a committee or a director or whoever wants to raise questions with me and say, here's the kind of problem we're struggling with, has somebody done something that's creative with that, by all means write me a note or give me a call, and I'll suggest that you look at such and such a catalog or talk to such and such a person, because you aren't blazing a trail as if no one has been there. There are 85 schools that are already going down that trail, and a lot of blind alleys have already been discovered. There's no point in you going down them if that can be avoided, and a 30-minute conversation with somebody would be helpful. But I commend this kind of dialogue within the faculty about the structure of what you want to do in the program to you, with the hope that it will do two things. It will give you the opportunity of ministering fruitfully, usefully, to a cadre of the graduates of this school and your sister institution who want to come back and study with you, but it'll also do something good to you. I think that teaching DMIN students has been the most useful experience the theological faculty have had in the last 10 years. It has brought them into touch with contemporary ministry, contemporary questions in ministry that many professors had not addressed in a long time. Let me be personal again as I close and illustrate that. Back before I became a bureaucrat, and before that an academic dean who didn't do much teaching, I used to know a little bit about religious education. And a few years after I became dean, I told my colleagues one time that I thought that I probably could devise the best darn Christian education program for a local Methodist church in the 1950s as anybody in the United States. But after that, I didn't know much. That's one of the problems that we faculty members face, in that even a few years of distance from the experience in the parish leaves us at something of arm's length from it. Even though we are practicing church members in a parish, we function more as laymen in the parish than as clergy. And the dialogue with your better graduates who will be DMin students is an excellent learning tool for you. To quote the current dean at Princeton Seminary, Charlie West, after one day in a day-long DMin seminar that was built around case material stuff, which no professor got a chance to lecture at all, Charlie came out of it wringing his hands and saying, how in the world am I ever going to teach theology under these circumstances? At the end of the year, he said, that's the best teaching experience I have ever had. Now, how can I reorganize my MDiv courses in the light of what I've learned from that? I wish you well in the enterprise. Thank you for inviting me, and I'm available for a few minutes of talk back if you want to do that.
Thank you, Marvin. You might just as well stay up here. I'm sure there will be a lot of questions, and I think we have 15, 20 minutes or so if you'd like to ask the expert all you wanted to know about DMin questions that we're afraid to ask. Who would like to lead off? John? Dr. Klotz?
Marvin, you several times referred to this as a one-year program. When you use that term one year, what do you have in mind? Are you talking about equivalent of a year, and if so, how do you measure?
Yeah.
When you're talking about these two-day programs and one-week
programs? The language of standard says that it is one academic year or its equivalent. And the commission has had to struggle mightily with that. ATS has never been willing to get into what I call academic bookkeeping. That is, we've never defined an MDiv degree as 3 years of or 6 semesters of 15 hours, whatever. We've said it's 3 full-time years, and let you define by what you mean, define full-time in any way you want to, and give the credit equivalency to it that you think appropriate. So that Yale, for example, gives an MDiv for 72 semester hours. Somebody else gives the MDiv for 96 semester hours. I'd be hard-pressed to try and prove that the second school has a 24-hour better degree than Yale does. They just have a different bookkeeping system in the way they work at it. What we have had to try to do is to look at the content of whatever the units that have been organized would be and make some kind of judgment about equivalency. Some of that is not a quantitative but a qualitative judgment that is based upon looking at the kind of work the students are doing. What the product is, you know, what the written work is, or that sort of thing. In some instances, there have not been as many of those, the term I used before, contact hours as the traditional class. But the end product of the course has been judged by the visiting team to be equal. It's a judgment call that the commission has to make.
Okay, Martin, Dr. Henschke, and then Dick Schultz.
Dr. Taylor, I'm interested in the clinical components of the DMin and pastoral care, and I enjoyed your coined phrase, we're uncomfortably comfortable with farming out our in-ministry students out in the field to other groups such as ACP and AAPC teaching units. Actually, we feel that the theological components must be at least comparable with the clinical components that are put into a DMin and pastoral care. How does the ATS view this kind of distribution? Now that almost calls for a two-year limitation because the clinical input calls for a three-year exposure.
A year.
So here we seem to be pushing too hard on the clinical, which we're somewhat uncomfortable to begin with. At the same time, we're trying to compensate by adding theological courses, which are in residence.
Schools that have really done a specialized pastoral counseling, DMin, have tended to require quantitatively more than schools that have had a, for want of a better
expectations clinically consume the year. And yet the school doesn't have the capacity to deliver that. It has to depend on relationships with other institutions. And if it has anything in the enterprise at all, then it has to be added on to that year. The commission has struggled with how to evaluate that. It, on the one hand, has been unwilling to criticize the school that had a year and a half beam in with a specialization in pastoral care, but on the other hand, it has often felt the school has compromised too much towards the clinical and not really rooted the clinical in the kind of classical understandings of ministers that we think are important. And so it sounds like you're saying, when you do that, it's the same for an institution that you have to exceed the requirement by 100% in order to be accredited. None of us have been very comfortable with that kind of situation. The only one I know that is a full 2 years is that Chicago thing. But some of that is part-time. That is, some of those people do have jobs. Or are maintaining small churches or one thing or another in addition to the study that they do.
Okay, I guess Dick was next. Dick, Dr. Schultz.
The last part of